The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
All right, well, basically the paper that I've shared with you that I've written for the Calvin Theological Journal indicates the breadth and confusion that governs this whole area of covenant theology. It's really remarkable when you take a look at how very different and varied the thinking is. One would think that if there is a brand of theology called covenant theology in the world, that everyone would know where it came from, but that's not the case. My purpose in writing this article was to challenge one of the most popular notions, and if you just put it into a graphic pattern, basically the idea is that covenant is intention with God's predestination, okay? And that there is a dialectic between those two. And if we go back to where we left off in our last class, you'll remember we said that in the medieval period, we had the tensions between the nominalists and the Neo-Augustinians. And we won't take time to redevelop that whole process of the faciendibus principle and the different types of merit, meritum de congruo, meritum de condigno, and the idea of how the covenant was developed in this sense to harness, if you will, a sovereign God. Whereas that was seen as a new Pelagianism, and there was a re-established Neo-Augustinian thought. And so the tension between covenant and predestination is not a new question. It goes back into the medieval period. And when we talk later today, we're going to talk about Luther's struggle of how do these two things impact him. And now we're way down here with Calvin, who is a second-generation reformer. In the middle, we have to put in here the work of Zwingli and Bullinger. All of these great thinkers, in different ways, had intellectual discourse with one another. They were reflecting one another's thought and developing it. So the lecture pattern that we're going to do is we're going to deal today with Luther, a session on Zwingli and Bullinger, and then we'll get back to Calvin. And the article that I've given you for this reading today is really looking at Calvin because that sets the backdrop of the development of where we're going. And what I hope you got from reading that, basically, is that scholars, as they look at Calvin, right up to this very time, are really doing almost the same thing that we can see going on in the medieval period, saying that covenant theology was developed precisely to handle God's sovereignty, to somehow put it into meaning, give it force. And that, therefore, we look at Calvin as this great predestinarian theologian teaching the dreadful decree, you know, the double predestinarian theology, and that we find out of that growing, in contrast, from Bullinger, a very different kind of covenant theology, which we can call the theology of the Rhineland Reformers, the Rhinelanders. And the man who popularized that theory was a professor at Yale by the name of Trinerud, who's a great Puritan scholar. And his basic thesis is that there is a very different approach to the covenant that emerges from the Rhineland Reformers, Bullinger and Zwingli especially, over against Calvin. And there's a sense in which Calvin represents the strong predestinarianism. Rhinelanders represent more of a one-sided predestination and an emphasis on covenant. And the thrust of this article was just simply to point out that Calvin continuously intersects covenant and predestination, that there's this constant overlap. And that's what I want you to see just by way of giving the thought, that the problem continues to come up. We can see it in the medieval period. We see that scholars are trying to do this with Calvin. And then a little bit later, if you continue on, you'll find that that same idea is developing again in the later reformers such as Olivianus and his contemporaries, so Ursinus. So that's the purpose of that, okay? Just to let you see, it's a constant pattern all the way through. So if you look at the origins of covenant theology, it's one way to look at it is, how does covenant and predestination work together? That keeps coming up no matter where you look at it historically. So today, let's take now the handout on Luther, and I'd like to just work through this with you and highlight some significant things as we go through. This is the fourth chapter out of my dissertation, and I call it The Covenant and the Theology of Martin Luther. And what we want to see now is that Luther, as a theologian, is taking his thinking in the context of the late medieval period, and he is already keenly aware of the problems between these two schools. And that's kind of where we left off last time. So let's pick up with the second full paragraph on the page on page one, or the second paragraph, I should say. It says, in view of Luther's extensive training in medieval theology, when we consider his idea of the covenant, we should expect an acceptance of the medieval variety of covenant in his early stage. But after the task of reformation has begun, we should expect a view of the covenant that clearly reflects his newly developed thought. And so, as you come to the question, right from the beginning, if Luther is growing out of the nominalist Neo-Augustinian conflict, he's going to be reflecting that. And obviously, the idea of a covenant of merit, where God gives grace to the one who does his best within himself, is something that's totally anathema to Luther's justification by faith alone, an imputation of an alien righteousness. So the question is, how does he get from one to the other? And the most important work for us to think about is what I mentioned here on this next paragraph, is the Dictatus Psalterium. That was his lectures on the Psalms, done in 1513. Those have not been translated into English, so they're largely inaccessible unless you're willing to wade into Latin. He was writing as a Latinist at this point. And so in that particular work, you can find Luther in his pre-reformational thinking, dealing with all the great passages that talk about merit, seemingly, Lord, justify me or accept me for my good works, judge me according to my works. Those are in the Psalms. You may remember those. The Lord will record a man, or reward a man according to his deeds. But also talks about forgiveness. And so here's Luther looking in these passages in that historical context. And it's fascinating to see how he's going back and forth on those kind of ideas and his Reformation theology begins to emerge. So that's what we're looking at. And what I want you to see is that in the middle of that struggle, the covenant is right in the heart of it. So covenantal thinking is part of the reformational developmental thought of Luther. Okay? Let's go to the continuing on page 98 there. It says, Luther's self-conscious employment of the covenant idea is illustrated by the range of his vocabulary with respect to the term covenant itself. For example, commenting on Psalm 83:6, Luther uses the phrase testamentum, and then in that phrase, notice he uses the Latin word pactum et fidus, and then he goes into German and says ein Bund gemacht. So he says testament, pact, federal, whatever English you want to say, covenant. So he has quite a broad range of synonyms that are at work in his covenantal thought, and he says that that all is understood in the phrase making a covenant. So Luther, in his comments, says we need to see that there's a testament, a pact, and a fidus. Pactum, fidus, and testamentum. Now, are they all the same? Are they different? That's one of the issues. And it's fascinating as you go through the development of covenantal thought, you'll find that different nuances begin to develop on these terms. Testamentum can certainly emphasize the idea of a one-sided application, whereas the idea of a pact and federation has much more of a mutuality. So that, how do these all work together? And here Luther is defining a testament in the same sense as a pact and the same sense as a fidus. Okay? And I make the comment that Augustine had understood those terms to be synonymous earlier on. To anticipate where we're going to end up, we're going to find that Luther will eventually understand the covenant entirely as a testament. It's a one-sided act of God. The mutuality is eventually going to be lost. And so just so you can keep the picture of what I'm going to try to show you now, we're going to see Luther moving from a late medieval covenantal theology along the Gabriel Biel model of merit theology, which is mutual, to a reformational kind of mutuality, until finally Luther is going to end up with a one-sided testamental or testamentary thought that reflects the Lutheran idea of an alien righteousness. And so we'll try to show you that in his thinking. Okay, let's go on to page 99. At the top of the page, it says, Luther often identifies covenant with promise as well. So another synonym for him is covenant, pact, fidus, and promise. Okay, next full paragraph. In general terms, Luther's primary usage of the covenant falls into two categories. Now, this is the pre-Reformational Luther, the early Luther. It says, the first use is to show the contrast between the Old and New Covenants. Okay, we would expect that. That's a good biblical sense from Jeremiah 31, Old Covenant, New Covenant. But in this view, the Old Covenant was built upon works of merit and thus was destined to become void by man's inability to keep his covenant condition. So the early Luther sees the Old Testament as largely a covenant of merit. And we'll show you a quote where he says this in just a moment. But to get the concept, he's saying that the covenant is man's effort to merit the redemption of God. On the other hand, the new covenant was built upon the promise of God and hence was eternal since God's grace established it. Okay, now listen to the quote for that we get here from Luther where he develops this. And this is from Psalm 89:35. But it's a lengthy quote and I think you can hear all that I've just said. Quoting from Luther now, by this it is apparent, Luther says, that the new law did not begin by our works and merit, thus it did not fall by our faults. Rather, it began, stands, and will continue by the mere promise, mercy, and truth of God. So he's talking about the new covenant here. It's all of God, all of grace. But this is not true of the old law, because it was given under such a condition that if it was fulfilled, it stood, but if it was not fulfilled, it fell, because it was established in their works and not in the mercy and pure promises of God, but with the inclusion of their works. Whence Jeremiah 31 says, they have made my covenant void. It says that it was made void, which nevertheless was of them, since they did not serve faithfully. Okay, so the point here is that you might begin to see is that Luther sees the Old Testament as a covenant of works. Okay, he doesn't call it directly a covenant of works. But he's, as a late medieval theologian, he's saying the old covenant is really a covenant of works that was broken, men have fallen, and now they need a new covenant of grace. Okay, I'll let him go on a little bit further and listen to what else he says after the Jeremiah 31 quote we pick up. It says, but not so the one of Christ, which no man is able to void, however much they may sin, because it stands in the grace of God, not in our works. And this is by mercy, which this psalm sings with a certain magnificence and harmony. Then he goes on a little bit further. He says, this one, however, if they do not keep it, indeed thus far is my mercy. Whence and when the faithful sin, all the church is punished, the good with the evil, but the covenant is not voided. Formerly, moreover, if a few sinned, the covenant was dissolved, because it was established upon their works. Now, some thought. If you understand Luther as the reformer, you'll remember that he says his divinity, he says the sum of my divinity is the distinction between the law and the gospel. Okay? You can already see that at work in Luther here. It's coming out of his idea of the old covenant, the new covenant. The old covenant is of merit. It is the law. It is of works. The new covenant is of grace, and it doesn't matter what sin may be, it's going to stand. Okay, so you begin to see the dialectic of covenant and merit and covenant and grace. Tim.
Sort of
That's right. And in other words, and that raises a problem that he has to recognize, is that if it, everybody broke it, so was there any redemption? So the first thing that you need to ask is this already a beginning of a covenant of works theology? And will later theologians pick up some of this and push it back to just the fall? But what you're going to find out that there are Reformed theologians even who will describe the era under Moses as a unique reestablishment of the covenant of works. So this is, there's a couple ways you can see this developing later. But it is the whole Old Testament era. Okay, and he's going to have to pick that up in just a few minutes. We'll see what he does with it. Well, was no one saved then back then? Okay. Let's go further. He says, here we see the beginnings then of the law-gospel distinction. The old covenant is the law of merit, and the new is the promise of grace without works. And he then will talk more about the fact that it can be broken. Let's go to page 101. The next, starting at the first full sentence, it says, it is only because of God's covenant that faith and grace justify the sinner. In fact, this justification occurs in the covenant. And so I think another remarkable thing to note is that Luther is already understanding in this point in his theology that justification is where forgiveness comes, and that is God's covenant, and it is through Christ. So it's fascinating as you see some of what his later theology will be, it's beginning to show itself, that there is justification, it's through Christ, and that's distinct from works of law, which is merit, but he's applying it almost like a hermeneutical difference, the Old Testament, the New Testament. Again, picking up under the quote, it says, again, here is the most remarkable statement of what would become the dominant feature of Luther's theology, justification by faith and grace. And here's the point that I think we need to sense. Yet at this stage, Luther is still the agonizing medieval monk seeking a gracious God. The two great basics of his mature theology have here manifested themselves. That is the law-gospel distinction and justification by faith. Why is there no joy of salvation and forgiveness at this point in Luther's spiritual struggle? In other words, you have to ask the question, here he is a medieval monk still saying, where can I find a gracious God? Yet he's writing about the fact that there's this covenant of justification, and it's through Christ, and there's really forgiveness of sins. It was the old covenant that was a covenant of law. Well, the answer maybe is found as we go along in what else Luther has to say about the covenant. Okay, we go on further. For coupled with this first usage of the covenant that distinguished the law of merit in the old covenant from the covenant of justification by faith in the new covenant was a second usage of the covenant idea. Okay, so what I'm going to suggest now is that we can find in Luther, even though it's not perfectly applied, as he will later develop it in his Reformation, he has law-gospel distinction, and he understands gospel is justification, righteousness, it is by faith, it's grace, but still, he's trying to make it fit with late medieval covenant theology, and that's what we see next. The second aspect of Luther's covenant thought incorporated the idea that the promise of God's grace in the new covenant does not exclude the necessity of man's doing. That is, man's responsibility of preparing for grace. It is at this point that one can discern Luther's adherence to the nominalist's covenant idea of facientibus, or to the one who does, as presented by Beale and Holcott. Okay, so I'm going to suggest to you that when you read Luther's Dictatus Salutarium, what you discover are two theological systems that he's still trying to tie together under the rubric of covenant. He has said that there is the old ways of law, the new ways of faith, the two covenants are different, and that we understand that in this new covenant there's justification by faith. But what he's going to say is that somehow the old covenant's demand is still present in this new era, and somehow the blessings of the new covenant was somehow anticipated in the old, so that there could be salvation back then, and yet the demand for the one who does and works hard is still here. Tim, again. Well, see, James' great statement where he says it's an epistle of straw, that comes up in his preface to the New Testament. In other words, it's his translation of the New Testament's first edition. So that's after the Reformation has begun. Okay, this is now when Luther is not doesn't even understand what's yet ahead. 1513. So we've got about maybe 8 years difference in time, and he's still trying to figure out what the gospel is. So when he struggles later with James, and he in essence says, well, James is a book of straw that we don't use because he's mistaken. You see, he doesn't struggle with James anymore. But this is his struggle now because he's under James's theology as he would understand it. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, so keep in mind where we are. It's the medieval Luther. It's not Luther the Reformer that we're dealing with here. Okay, other comments? Stop me at any point to make sure we're clear. Go ahead. Well, there have been some who have argued that when you get into the Puritan preparationism that comes up, that it's a return to a medieval congruism. That is an honest charge that has been brought, that what you're doing is you're trying to teach grace, but then you turn around and say you've got to go through this particular way of getting ready for it. And so the problems come back again and again. And the question is, did they pick them up by reading these guys, or is it inherent in the struggle to understand covenantal thought? And that's part of really what I'm trying to say here, that medieval predestination and conditionality of the covenant are one-sided. That's there. We can find it again in Calvin. You can find it later. And you can get three or four or five times in the history of the covenant, this problem keeps coming up again and again. Is it inherited or is it rediscovered? That's a legitimate question. It's hard to know. But I think you could find a lot of formal similarities between the preparationism of the medieval period and the later form. And some theologians have criticized that and said, what you're doing is you're going back to medieval theology. Okay, so it's an honest question, and I can't answer precisely, but others have raised it and said, yes, maybe at some points it is. Okay. All right, let's continue then. All right, let's carry on with the next paragraph here. Because of the technical character of this, I thought I'd give you the actual words so you can review and just follow. Forgive me, I'd rather lecture, but I think it's better to try to follow the precise thinking here. It says, in the second category, Luther again sees two primary references of the covenant idea that more or less correspond to his distinction between the old covenant of merit and the new covenant of faith and grace by God's promise. The only difference is that Luther desires to show that the Old Testament saints were not destitute of grace because they only had a covenant of works and merit, and that the New Testament believers, although having a covenant of promise and faith, did not have the privilege of being excluded from the responsibility of merit. In other words, the two covenants, in a sense, overlap one another. While the old is a merit covenant, there still is grace. While the new is a promise covenant, there is yet merit. It is perhaps this lingering element of merit in the new era that troubled Luther in his Anfechtungen. That was his despair and struggle that he talked, his temptations. All right. Let me read the next quote so you can hear a little bit of his use now of the medieval covenant right in the same work, Psalm 115, just a few psalms after the one that we were reading. As he's expounding it, he's now going to turn back to medieval nominalistic covenant theology, page 103. It says, because not by our merit, but by the mere promise of God's mercy. So that's part of this. So you know he's talking about promise and mercy from God. And then he says, indeed he promised before the advent of the spiritual age, ask and you'll receive, seek and you'll find, knock and it will be opened unto you. Indeed, all who ask receive, etc. Hence the doctors, that is the teachers of the church, say rightly that to the man who does what is in himself, God infallibly gives grace. So there he is. He's quoting now the late medieval covenant theology, even though earlier he had this great distinction between law and grace and the covenant of justification. Now he says, yet we must understand that in this, that there is this principle of that God gives grace to the one who does what is within himself. And he goes on to say, and although it is not possible to prepare themselves for grace by worthiness, because it is incomparable, nevertheless they can de congruo, on account of that promise of God and the covenant of mercy. Okay, so now what we find here is Luther picks up Beale's theology and says it is still in force, that God is giving grace to the one who does the best that is in themselves. That was true in the Old Testament era. So while it was a covenant of merit, the forgiveness of sins, and yet if they did their best, there could be forgiveness. But we are now living in a new age of forgiveness. But this covenant is still in works, which means that you've got to do enough. Have you done your best? Even though you're... So here's the tension of two systems struggling in Luther. They're put side by side. And one way of viewing Luther's Reformation breakthrough is actually the dissolution of that linkage. He jettisons the medieval system for the one that he's... I have a hard time understanding what he's saying there, because he's saying two things that are contradictory at the same time. Okay? They're woven together. So the late medieval period is a dialectic of covenantal thought in Luther, where he's trying to put together the great late medieval system. Let's jump over a few more pages here, and let's go to page 108, just for an example of some of the later thinking of Luther just before the Reformation. Those are several examples out of the Dictatus Salutarium. Start at the first full sentence at page 108 at the top. It says, "Yet even here the early Luther struggled. If God had made a covenant to accept man's half merit of preparation for grace, was this not really grace itself? Did merit really have any meaning at all, since man's activity only had consequence in view of the divine covenant promise? Was it not really God who binds himself to man in covenant by mercy rather than God paying a debt to man for his preparing for grace?" But the early Luther was not able to discard this conception of the covenant. He was too faithful a son of the Mother Church to make such a drastic move. Thus, in his lectures on Romans, begun at Easter of 1550, now we're a couple years later, after his lectures on the Psalms, he's now turning to Romans. And that is the book that's in the Library of Christian Classics, Luther on Romans. That's still Luther as the medieval monk writing. Okay, you need to understand that. He's still trying to come to his conclusions. And you can find, even this late, his use of the medieval covenant theology. So notice his comments on Romans 2:14. Remember the phrase where it says, "The Gentiles who do by nature the things of the law." This is what he says. "Therefore, I think that he really has in mind those who stand in between the godless Gentiles and the believing ones, people who by some good action toward God, according to the measure of their natural ability, earned grace, which then directed them farther, not as if grace were given to them in recognition of such a merit, because then it would not have been grace, but because they thus prepared themselves for receiving it as a free gift." Okay? Grace means merit. Merit means grace, but not completely. Okay, so he's trying to inch for it, but he can't quite break it yet. So what he's saying is that there are people who are trying to earn grace. So there's the merit theology still at work. That's the late medieval covenant theology of the meritum de congruo at such a late date. Turn to page 109. "But this theology of preparationism, free will or natural ability, and the association of merit and grace give way, just as Luther is planning his attack upon the doctrine of indulgences." Okay, you remember the great date, 1517. So something big has happened between, in his theological mind, between 1515 now and 1517. September 1517 antedates the 95 Theses. Okay, remember that's October. This is before, just a few weeks before the 95 Theses are posted. Luther writes in his disputation against scholastic theology. Isn't this interesting? That now he's come to the point where he says, "I want to have a debate, and I want to debate the scholastic theology." That is the theology of the late medieval theologians like Gabriel Beale and Holcott and the other nominalists. And so some of the theses that come directly out of that disputation are here. Number 5, it says, "It is false to say man is free to move in either a good or an evil direction, since he is not free but captive." This against common opinion. So one of the things he says is that "I no longer believe in free will." In other words, it's not man in his nature deciding whether he's going to do the best in himself. He needs God's grace to enable him. Number six, it is false to say man's will can by nature conform to a right dictate of reason. This against Scotus and Gabriel. That is, that man cannot with his mind say, this makes real reasonable sense and I will choose to conform it. That is kind of doing what's in myself. I can't do what's in myself to do what's right. Number seven, without the grace of God, the will necessarily chooses what is evil and perverse. Instead of what we read in Romans 2 from his commentary, where there are these people between the godless and the redeemed who choose to do what's right, he says that's impossible. So you see, Luther's rejecting his own theology up to this point. He's turning his back on what he's written. Number 17, it says, it is not true that man by nature wants God to be God. By nature, he rather wants himself to be God. Number 20, an act of friendship between man and God comes not by nature, but by prevenient grace. This against Gabriel. Number 29, the highest and surest preparation and the singular disposition for grace is the eternal election and predestination of God. See, here's Luther saying, how do you prepare for grace? Do you do what's in yourself? No. It's God's preparation of you for grace by his decree of predestination. And number 30, and on the part of man, nothing precedes grace except a disinclination toward it, nay, rebellion against it. Now, where and when exactly Luther makes his final discovery between these two dates is for another lecture and another study. But what I want you to see then, just as if I can put it, so we understand how covenantal theology begins to emerge. There is a late medieval system that's right here, this faciendibus principle. Luther is talking about covenant, and he develops his system as a covenantal dialectic of a covenant of merit and a covenant of forgiveness and its intention, and that with the Reformation breakthrough, he just basically says, I no longer can keep these two together. And this breaks, okay? Now, we still have to say, well, how does he get around the fact that someone must have been saved in the Old Testament if it was a covenant of merit? What's going on? And how do we deal with obedience in the new era? That's going to be a problem. So let's take a look now as we see Luther clearly has made a break by 1517. He's actually asking for a debate on scholastic theology, saying, I want to debate my brothers in the theological world on this issue. Well, what happens now to covenantal thinking in Luther's mind? Okay, he's had two covenantal type systems in tension, and he jettisons the late medieval. What carries over? And what happens to that system? Well, now let's go on to our next section here. With this definitive return to Augustinianism, it is not surprising that Luther begins to express his conception of the covenant in a manner very similar to Augustine himself. Luther remarks, he who stays alive makes a covenant. He who is about to die makes a testament. Okay, that's a quote from Luther's Galatians commentary in 1519. So he begins to say, we need to see a difference between testament and covenant. They're not exactly the same. Earlier, he saw them very much as synonyms. Remember, he said covenant could be defined, this German word, Bund, as testamentum pactum fidus, all kind of the same. Now he's beginning to say, no, wait, there's a difference between testament. There's a difference between covenant. A covenant is for the living, whereas death interposes in the case of a testament. And then he explains, thus Jesus Christ, the immortal God, made a covenant. Let's give me 5 minutes and we'll get to a good point to break here. He says, at the same time, he made a testament because he was going to become mortal. Just as he is both God and man, so he made both a covenant and a testament. So what is he saying now? Basically, that Jesus Christ as man, as a living man, makes a covenant of a relationship. But he also is going to become a testator. The cross is in view. He's going to die. And as one who makes a testament, his death is going to bequeath certain wonderful gifts to his people that he names in his testament. So he sees them both to be true. But now notice the significance is not so much the individual entering into covenant. By doing what is in himself, he's beginning to focus the covenant and testament upon Jesus Christ. So there's a change from the focus of the individual working and laboring in prevenient grace and disposing himself to grace and covenant to Christ's work in grace. Now notice how this will work out in some practical applications in his theology. Let me begin reading under the citation. Because Jesus Christ is God and God is the source of eternal life itself, he had to make a covenant and not a testament. That is, God doesn't die. However, since Jesus Christ had become a man with the express purpose of dying, he could, in fact, make a testament. This is the very point that Augustine had made with respect to the exact differences between testament and covenant. Further, in accord with Augustine's stress upon the bilateral character of the covenant, Luther also sees the idea of man's responsibility in the covenant, particularly in his exposition of baptism as a covenant. Now, you may not be aware of this, but Luther actually early on used covenantal thinking to explain infant baptism and believer's baptism. That's not just a Reformed concept. That actually is found in the early Luther. And so writing in 1519 in his work, The Holy and Blessed Sacrament of Baptism, baptism is seen as God's making a new covenant with man. Notice, not a testament now, but a new covenant. Thereby God assures man that he will forgive his sins throughout life and will at the same time put man's sins to death. However, in baptism, man obligates himself to realize the significance of his baptism. Thus he is to, quote, to submit himself into the sacrament of baptism, to participate in God's gracious work in him by fighting against sin and killing it until he himself dies. And so what you see there at that point is now a real mutuality in grace, where the believer in sanctification is trying to put to death his old nature. God graciously establishes the covenant in baptism, and the believer responds to it. So what we need to see now is, I don't have an eraser here, so we'll scratch it. In the late medieval theology breaks out of Luther, and he begins to work now with this system. And what happens is as he emphasizes this, he says baptism is all of grace, but in grace there is both the gift and also a gracious enabling to be responsible. At this point, I think Luther is very close to the Reformed model. Okay, in his early Reformational thinking, as he views baptism, he sees it as within grace as God's sovereign gift that creates a responsibility in grace to act in a mutual covenant. We can see that in his teaching on baptism. Now, what I think is going to happen is that Luther's idea of baptismal covenant is going to be dropped, and he's going to change the idea of covenant into testament. He's already made them distinct, and we're going to find a few years later that Luther stops talking about the covenantal character of baptism and talks about them as a testamentary baptism. Okay? That's what we'll come back to after our break. We'll pick up with that. And we'll also have to talk about his hermeneutical developments here when we come back from break too. So let's stop for 10 minutes and we'll be back.